I'm Izzy. I front the band.
I'm Jack. I play lead guitar.
And he also does recording and producing most of the stuff, but he won't talk about it.
My name's Gideon. I play guitar and do some singing.
I'm Tom. I play lead bass.
I'm Luke. I play drums.
Lead drums.
The preachers.
So I'm going to fill in like a whole pile of blanks. Let's see. There was a meeting of some of you in high school. There was the Australian Institute of Music. There was another member that was met at a dive bar. There was an EP before the drummer. You paid your dues, blah, blah, blah. Right? So now we're done. That's it. But there's stuff between the lines.
I like that story that you were in another band called Izzy and the Gingers. And you were famous in like French Polynesia. Yeah. Parts of the Pacific Islands. I think that's a pretty good story.
Is it a true story?
It's hard to say.
Oh,
it's
so
this is a period of history that doesn't include us. It's prehistory.
I was on the ground. I was an eyewitness to it. It was a long time ago though. Memory's a little hazy.
You weren't one of the gingers.
You know
what?
No, I wasn't one of the gingers. I wasn't. Yeah. You know, they say if you can remember it, you weren't there. So I can't remember it. Ginger Baker? No.
Ginger Baker.
How many people were in the band?
I don't know. I can't remember.
Oh, no.
It was between 3 and 5.
But we did an infamous tour of New Caledonia. And we were sent to a, I guess what you'd call a produce and livestock show, like an Easter sort of
show.
Hey,
come buy my cow.
No, he didn't. It was done through the college that I was attending at the time. And there was a rigorous audition process.
As there are in most livestock.
As there are in most traveling
most
bands.
Is, really
is she bovine enough?
We played all mostly country and classic rock covers. So we did The Gambler. We did.
Did you do The Gambler as classic rock though?
No, we did it more as country. Yeah, and I just remember not being able to sing it at all.
Do any Simply Red?
No, I didn't do any Simply Red.
Yeah,
but it's. What else did we do? We did.
You did a lot of Credence, I think.
Credence.
Yeah, we did a lot of Credence, and everyone
in
got.
A Creole style.
I remember
Creole
that.
Style, yes.
I remember that everyone got salmonella poisoning from a bad batch of prawns that they were serving at the cafeteria because there was nowhere to wash your hands at this place. And then I remember being really weirded out because after I left the stage, we did like 3 sets over a couple of days and they were playing us over the loudspeaker system in the grounds of this like weird show.
You're doing this so well.
Yeah, so that was my first experience of being in a band.
I bet 72% of the world doesn't know who Vanda and Young are. Let's take the songwriting competition a little differently because to you, Vanda and Young, and winning something like that and being in their shadow is a pretty cool thing.
So. Harry Vanda and George Young were so, I guess, famous and infamous within music circles and songwriting circles that Mark Knopfler from Dire Straits actually shouted out to them in one of the greatest songs of all time, Sultans of Swing. And there's that line, Harry doesn't mind if he doesn't make the scene. He's got a daytime job. He's doing all right.
Check out Guitar George. He knows all the chords. Strictly Rhythm. He
doesn't want to make a cry or sing.
You could go on forever.
Yeah. So George was in the Easy Beats. And Harry Vanda was label man, songwriter, A&R guy. He did everything, well. Really. And George Young, of course, is older brother to Malcolm and Angus of a little Australian band called AC/DC.
Now headlining a Coachella near you.
Now, yeah.
Well, they probably were now that their drummer's in jail for...
No, the drummer got out.
He
got out. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
In true AC/DC form, they found him on the street.
He'll do.
They found him on the street. He knew the beats. He was able to play.
He knew the beat, the one beat.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's it. Oh, yeah, opening for the Rolling Stones, right? I mean, that's cool. That's amazing. But more importantly, what I want to talk about in relation to that and the Jimmy Kimmels and all these things that are the, you know, the pull quotes, right? That make you the, you know, the future biggest band in the world because of association. But that doesn't mean that you've like magically gotten rich yet, right? And, you know, being written up in Marie Claire and Teen Vogue and all of this hype and all this great stuff. What's your real perception of on this big tour, you know, promoting the first big debut album? What's your real perception of how it's all going?
I remember when I was a fan and looking at bands that I thought had cracked it and made it, and what constituted like making it for me, and how really little a band had to do to do that in my eyes.
And then reality struck.
The reality is very different. But you know, this tour has been great for us. We've come back to places like this, like the Independent in San Francisco, which we played last time we were here. There was a massive game on for some kind of sport.
Giants
and
were
Giants won the World Series.
World Series
so you had about 50 people.
We had about 50 people here, and they all looked like games. They all looked like they wanted to you know, they were trying to scratch an itch that they couldn't possibly scratch.
San Francisco and Kansas City Royals were playing, and I remember the feeling was pretty intense. But that idea of kind of coming back to a place that you've played.
Well, you can see the dent you made last time.
You get to
it's so
it.
Satisfying. Yeah. It's not like just suddenly jumping into this big auditorium or theater or
it's small progress.
It's like it's really satisfying to come back and just be like, yeah, we've conquered that little piece of territory for ourselves, you know. But that's like for an Australian band, I guess, to come overseas and do that with the Aussie dollar the way it is. It's really tough. It's we make big losses going on tour. People don't seem to understand. Like, they come up to us at, and you know, they shouldn't have to understand. You know, it's not their job as fans to understand the reality. You know, it's up to us to keep the mystery, because that's what's so important about the music is the mystery. And I feel like so much of the current climate is deconstructing the mystery for people.
Over time, I think it gets really difficult for you to classify change in any one single direction, because it's usually a culmination of a series of things that are happening, whether they're in culture or in society or in the world around you. And the music that you're making is genuinely a response to all of those things, and you can never classify just one. And it has to filter it down somewhere, because it's easier for us to describe those things in a single term.
My issue is that it's not enough to just be a pop rock band. And I don't think that's right. You know, it's like if people ask me to describe our sound, I'm like, well, we're pop rock. And they're like, ooh, that sounds terrible. It's gotten askewed, you know, it's gotten askewed from what it is. And we actually had an interview in Sydney with like a street press, local street press. And I talked a lot about pop in the interview and how much I loved pop and how much I wanted to write a great pop song and learn what that meant for me, you know, because that's the craft to me. Like, that's what it's all about. And you need the craft to be able to go on and break the rules if that's what you're going to do. But pop to me is like Downtown Train by Tom Waits, or like, you know, the Everly Brothers, or Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow by Goffin and King, Holland, Ozzy or Holland, Beatles, you know, Lennon, McCartney, great songwriters. They're the bedrock, you know. And I think we've broken away from that, because it's necessary to break away from traditions in any way when you're trying to innovate and create new things. But you have to know the craft, just like Picasso had to know the craft of, you know, impressionist painting or realism or whatever I've forgotten my art history. I'm an idiot.
This very room won Mercury Rev probably 4 years ago. Was on this very thing that you're talking on. So were you Mercury Rev fans, or was it just you liked back to songs, you liked that particular line in a song?
We didn't even know about it. But you know what? I think it was one of those subconscious things, because my dad loved Mercury Rev and he always used to play me a lot.
We weren't
going to
talk about what our dads listened
Rev.
To.
Pardon?
We weren't going to talk about what our parents listened to.
Well,
no,
I get fucked.
No, I said I wasn't going to ask you.
But my dad,
very good.
my dad I mean, he was a big Mercury Rev fan. He used to play me a lot of different stuff, a lot of 90s stuff. But I never really got into them when I was... they weren't one of the bands that he played me that I loved. And it was that and, you know, maybe PJ Harvey that I found really difficult to get into when I was that age. And they're now some of my favourite artists.
Yeah, it's not easy stuff.
Well, it's just takes growing into, you know, like I got into, well, not necessarily, like I got into Bob Dylan when I was about 14 and got into Patti Smith and a lot of stuff, but there were some artists that just took a bit more time. So when we were doing Blue Planet Eyes, it was originally called, was it Fuckwit or Gajoob? I can't remember.
Which one are you talking about?
Blue Planet Eyes.
Oh, yeah, it was just some of the instrumental thing. I think it was called Duff.
Yeah, Jack used to spend a bit of time, you know, between getting the bus to the studio in the mornings, coming up with an idea, and then he'd spend half an hour on it. And this was just one of the ideas. And that just popped into my head. And then I looked it up online and I was like, oh, that's nice. I like that because I like that song. And it must have just stuck in my head without even realizing it.
Okay, so let's get geeky for a couple of minutes. I'm going to do the full announcer voice, about the recording at Public Hi-Fi. But I also happen to know that you might have gone back after you recorded at least a couple of things and went back home and said, there's a few things, there's at least one we want to re-record. There's some things that we want to, you know, and it's kind of that when you're there and you're in a place like that and you're with the producer that you wanted and you got him and I know you got along and I've read all of that, but I'm kind of more interested in when you stepped back, when you got home, when you listened to it, what were the things you said that you said, you know what, this isn't quite right. We might want to re-record this. We might want to tweak this. And obviously there was a co-producer involved. It wasn't just a solo effort between you and him. So who wants to take that and tell me a little bit about that?
That is true. I mean, you always get to that point in a project where you sort of wonder what you've done. And we were fortunate that we had recorded, I guess, in the middle of a big tour. So we got 3 weeks in Austin. We did Coachella. We came back home to Australia. We really didn't have that
long. It's quite simple, though. It's like we just realized that we didn't capture what we wanted to capture for those particular things that we redid.
There were lots of other things on my mind, though, and I think that one of them was knowing that there was a great aesthetic that I'd hit on that we'd all managed to kind of get like really well established when we did Is This How You Feel? So having that set up against all these other tracks that we did at Public Hi-Fi made it really obvious to me that there was a lot of things that needed to be changed in order to pull everything in line. And we did recut two songs. Two or three. Yeah, and then I spent a great deal of energy, I guess, just kind of, you know, nudging some things back into the place where I really wanted them to be. And it was great to have somebody else involved at that point where we were making the beds, because it's really good to have somebody else's kind of opinion at that point where you kind of like, maybe I'm thinking about this too much.
Just bounce stuff off people.
But yeah, for me, the really intense side of making the record was when we got away from Austin and we got back to Sydney. Because there was a lot more really kind of finite and in-depth work to do, and I guess searching, like finding pieces of that, you know, pieces of that picture that we hadn't quite put in place yet.
Yeah, and I really didn't do any vocals. I only did vocals for two tracks in Austin.
You're really sick.
I got Cedar fever and I was just fucking depressed and I just didn't want to do anything and the whole making the record just... It freaked me out. I'd never really been in that situation before. I wasn't used to working in a studio environment. I don't think studios are really very comfortable places. And it's hard to describe. Like, making the record, there's so many different things going on at one time. And it takes so much energy just to make a single decision. So much energy. And it's draining, you know? It's really draining. But the position that we were in as well, like we just come off two and a half months.
Yeah, we were already at the point where we'd sort of hit the wall and it was like, fuck, now we have to spend almost 4 weeks in this, like in isolation in a studio.
And that's, you know, that's everybody's dream to go in and do that. And we were really aware of that. But at the same time, it was just, it almost belies the fact that we came out with such a happy sounding record. I think, you know.
So what, before we get into the last thing we're going to do, I mean, you're going to make another record at some moment in time, I would imagine, right? Exactly. You're going to tour behind this, and then you're going to go, oh, we have to do this again. So given your not major love for the typical recording studio is really the learning that you're going to do it differently?
I think I definitely want to get back in the studio and make the next album. In fact, I'm chomping at the bit to go back in the studio.
Yeah.
And we all are. I think what made it so difficult for the first record was really the pressure, the intense pressure that we felt.
Such a small time span.
It's such a small time. I mean, we were fighting people from all sides who
is
wanted
this
us to.
You had the big producer and you had.
It was just the label back in Australia really wanting to release the record as soon as possible, and they, you know, they had their own like very good reasons for that, but for us it was like, no, we can't make a record in 3 weeks.
Are you still
like
with
it's
the
impossible.
Yeah.
They're great. I mean, we just fought them, which you do as a band. Yeah. You fight everyone, constantly fighting everybody.
I've invented a thing called a musical sandwich. And what it is two songs from The Preachers as the bread on the outside. And then you get to pick anything by anybody else in between.